It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up later, we'll hear the call for developing best practices for the use of body cameras in Wisconsin.
First, as a nationwide teacher shortage makes headlines, the number of teachers in training in Wisconsin is down, too. Some recent education graduates say they weren't prepared for the political climate in Wisconsin, while others worry about paying back student loans on a beginning teacher's salary. As the school year begins, some districts like La Crosse are reporting unfilled positions.
Joining us now to talk about the issue is Diana Hess. She's the dean of the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Education and a professor of curriculum and instruction. Diana, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, first off, is it fair to say that there is a teacher shortage in Wisconsin as there is in the nation at large?
Well, there are teacher shortages in Wisconsin. It's hard to tell at this point if they're as serious as they are in some other places. But, for example, we know that there are shortages in a number of urban school districts and a number of rural school districts. We know that there are shortages in a number of areas like special education, math, science, social studies, et cetera. So I think one of the things that's very interesting is that even though we don't know the exact figures right now for what's going on in Wisconsin over the entire state, we are hearing from school districts that this late in the summer they still have vacancies that they haven't filled, and that's really unusual.
And when you look at this question of unfilled teacher positions, having those vacancies, you look at the number of teachers who are, young people, students who are training to be teachers. What do we know about those numbers right now?
Well, across the country, we're seeing a dip in the number of young people who are going into university-based teacher education programs. In Wisconsin, we've seen that dip in some places, and other places we haven't seen it quite so much. I think what's happening is that there are a variety of reasons why teaching is not as attractive to young people as it was 5 or 10 years ago. So I think schools of education like here at the University of Wisconsin-Madison really need to focus on how we attract people into teaching.
You said there are a variety of reasons. What are some of those?
Well, I think one is that the economy in general is improving, and I think that in most states, including this one, teacher salaries are relatively low. They haven't kept up with other salaries. And so I think a lot of young people are really worried about that, especially since they're often coming out with a lot of student debt. So I think if we know that young people are coming out with more student loans now, it just makes sense that they would be less willing to go into professions that don't pay quite as much. So that's part of it, but I don't think that's the whole thing. I think there are a lot of other things that are happening. I think teachers are getting a lot of criticism, not just in Wisconsin, but across the nation. And there's just been a lot of rhetoric against teachers and against teaching. And I think for a lot of young people, they think, well, why would I want to do that then?
Now, after Act 10 passed here in Wisconsin, the collective bargaining rights of teachers was curtailed. And from what you know, did Act 10 have an impact on young people choosing teacher as a career or maybe choosing to stay in teaching?
I don't think we know yet. I mean, I think we really need some research on what impact Act 10 has had. I mean, I think what we know is that there's some national trends that appear to be also occurring in Wisconsin. You know, one of the things to think about is for a lot of teachers, they took a pretty dramatic pay cut after Act 10 because of the increased proportion that they had to pay into the pensions. And I think that probably made a difference. But I also think there was a morale problem. You know, I think there are a lot of teachers who feel like they are not being supported in the way they need to be supported, and they're, you know, it has become for some people not as rewarding of a job. On the other hand, I don't want to be too negative, because we know that there are lots of young people who are going into teaching and having very good experiences. So I think what we need to do is to make sure that we're providing the support we need to provide in schools so we can attract really high-quality teachers and keep them in the classroom. That's the other big thing, Veronica, that's changed. Is it used to be that people would go into teaching and stay in teaching for quite a long time. Now we know that a lot of people go into teaching, and pretty quickly, high percentages leave, and that's a real problem.
Right. According to one statistic, half of new teachers leave the profession within the first 5 years. Do you have any idea why that is happening?
I'm not sure it's quite that high now, but I think it's still high. And I think one reason that's happening is that teaching is an extremely difficult job. I think it's a harder job now than it was when I started teaching high school a long time ago. I know it's a harder job now. I think part of the reason it's harder is that Young people are coming to schools with a lot of needs. I think schools have a lot of responsibilities that schools didn't have 30 or 40 years ago. I think income inequality has really had an effect on how hard it is to teach. And I think teachers don't feel like they're getting the support they need. And so for that reason, I think some people, you know, come into teaching and very, you know, quickly decide, boy, this just isn't what I hoped it would be. That's not the case in all schools. We know that there are a lot of schools across the country, and certainly here in Wisconsin, where teachers come in, they're very, very happy, they're getting the support they need, they feel like they have good relationships with parents and with their colleagues and with administrators, and then they do stay.
We're talking right now with Diana Hess, Dean of the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Education. We're talking about falling numbers of new teachers in training here in Wisconsin and why that might be. And for a lot of graduates, one thing you're looking at is, what am I going to make when I get out of college in this profession? Because as we know, the affordability of college is a major factor, and the debt load when you graduate is something that students are looking at carefully. So what does a beginning teacher make, and what kind of raises might they expect?
Well, what a beginning teacher makes really differs from school district to school district. And I think that's something that we really need to be concerned about in Wisconsin. It's not unique to Wisconsin. But we know that in most states, school districts that are in wealthier communities can provide teachers with much higher salaries. And, you know, that's really a problem, because one of the things that we're hearing now is that school districts are able to attract teachers who are in lower paid school districts. So I think there's some concern about that. There's kind of more churning in the market than we've seen. But we know that, you know, teacher salaries are, for the most part, much lower than they would be for the other kinds of jobs that people would get who have had as much education and preparation as you have to have in order to teach.
And for a long time here in Wisconsin, salary increases were frozen. What is the case now?
You know, I'm not really sure how it looks across the state as a whole. You know, it certainly differs from district to district, but I'm not hearing my friends who are teachers talk about getting any kind of significant raises. But, you know, I don't want to focus too much on teacher salaries as an incentive. It certainly is important. But I think that there's something that bigger and more important that we as a society have to face up to, which is that we need to make sure that we are providing other kinds of support for teachers. You know, I think when teachers feel like they're under attack and they're not getting the resources that they need to do what they need to do in their classroom, it becomes very, very difficult. And so I think that we need to think carefully as a country and as a state about how we talk about and how we honor the people who are doing some of the jobs that are so important for the future of this country. When I went into teaching many, many years ago, you know, it was, you know, very easy to get lots of positive reinforcement. You know, people thought it was a very, very good thing to do. I think some young teachers now don't feel like that they're getting that kind of reinforcement. So I think as a country, we need to say, if education matters, then teachers matter.
Diana, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Diana Hess is the Dean of the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Education and a professor of curriculum and instruction. She joined us to talk about the falling numbers of new teachers in training here in Wisconsin.
1 year after the death of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, there have been a lot of calls around the nation for police departments to adopt body cameras for their officers, a technology that supporters say will help bring transparency to the police profession. Here in Wisconsin, law enforcement has been grappling with the issue in the wake of the fatal shootings of Milwaukee's Dontre Hamilton and Madison's Tony Robinson.
Our next guest says that while body cameras are a good idea, there are still questions out there to be answered. He says local governments are contemplating spending millions of dollars without an understanding of how to best use the technology. And he's calling on state officials and law enforcement to develop best practices for these cameras before making the investment.
Joining us now is Samuel Hall. He's a partner at Crivello Carlson SC and a police civil rights attorney. He recently explored this issue in an op-ed for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Sam, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Good afternoon, Rob. Glad to be here with you.
So the use of body cameras seems to be one of the biggest discussions in law enforcement these days, and you say you are all for officers wearing them. Why is that?
Sure. Well, you know, I think these body cameras are here to stay. They're not going to solve all of the concerns that the public has with policing. But if they're used properly and if the video is preserved, it could be a benefit to both the public and the police. From the officer's perspective, I think there's really two main reasons to use the camera. First, in our society today, more and more police contacts are being video recorded, whether it be in parking lots or in businesses or even walking down the street. And the problem is that video is usually recorded from high above the scene, and it affords a perspective and a point of view that the officer that's down on the ground doesn't have the luxury of having. And so if we're going to critique and judge police officer conduct from the perspective of the officer, which is what the law requires, then it only makes sense that the video be taken from that perspective. The second, big reason that many in law enforcement are supporting the use of body cameras is that they, have already been used to defeat claims of misconduct. Previously I've referenced this case in Albuquerque where a young lady was pulled over for a DUI, and after she was brought to the station, she decided to make an allegation that the male police officer had sexually assaulted her in the search back on the street. And, it was ironic. You hear the police officer actually chuckle a little bit because he knows that the whole stop, the whole search, everything was video recorded, and it ended up vindicating him. And, without body cameras, officers in that position are, their mind's racing. They're thinking about, are they possibly at risk of losing their career? And so, I think on the whole, if the cameras are used properly and if the video is preserved, they're going to be helpful to law enforcement, and certainly the public supports it.
Yeah, and the benefits to the public as you see it. And you mentioned that the ACLU is looking for, to help individuals record their own encounters. You see this as a benefit for public rights as well, if police are wearing the cameras.
Sure. It's another step in accountability. I don't think you need to look a whole lot further than the University of Cincinnati, the recent shooting involving Officer Ray Tenzing. And you look at the report that officer prepared, and you look at the report of his fellow officers that were at the scene, and boy, after you watch that video a couple of times, you have to wonder if they were at the same scene that the video depicts. And so there's undeniably a level of public accountability that comes with these. But I think the important thing is that, in my experience, I've represented hundreds of law enforcement officers. I've seen a real shift in opinion on this. I think there was some initial reluctance to it, but as we've gone further and further post Ferguson, I'm seeing more and more officers do support it if they're used properly and if the video is preserved.
Well, and there's the tricky bit. It's easy enough to say we need police body cameras and expensive but easy enough to put them in place. But then do we have standards? Do we have practices in place for how we use these things, especially here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, that's the problem. In Wisconsin, there is literally zero guidance to our police chiefs and our sheriffs and the local governments that are considering whether and how to implement these cameras. And, that's a real problem because within the use of these police body cameras, there's undeniably both privacy rights of witnesses and inside the home, and there's victims' rights issues as well. And so, Wisconsin has an open records law that strongly favors disclosure, and that has historically served our state very, very well. But it doesn't necessarily fit with body cameras. And so we're really, I think a lot of police chiefs and sheriffs are prudently sitting on the sidelines to wait to see, is there going to be any legislation on this? What kind of guidance can they get? And, a number of states have already taken action on this. Just recently, North Dakota almost unanimously adopted legislation that concluded that body camera video footage taken from a private place, so inside of a home, was completely exempt from public records disclosure. Arizona went so far as to propose legislation that exempted all body camera footage, whether it be in a public or private place, from open records law. I don't think we need to go that far. I think that's probably a step in the wrong direction. But it's clear there has to be some legislation, some best practices that are put into place if we want our police chiefs and our sheriffs and our local governments to sign on to this. The example I use all the time is, if a new weapon was created and it was going to be distributed to law enforcement officers, there is no way we would want that weapon put on an officer's utility belt until we knew exactly how and when that weapon could be used, in a certain situation. And the same thing is true here with these body cameras. It's prudent to allow these best practices to be developed and to be vetted before we, you know, implement this tool and potentially cause damage to victims, potentially cause damage to, those who have officers that come into their homes and hospital rooms and so on and so forth.
Sam, we'll get into some more of the questions that police body cameras raise. But before we do that, who do you think needs to take the lead here to establish these kind of practices and rules?
Well, I mean, the great thing is that the lead's already been taken. Attorney General Brad Schimmel, about a week ago or maybe 2 weeks ago, held an open government summit, and this issue was a hot topic discussed at that summit. Clearly, Attorney General Schimmel gets it. He understands this issue. He understands the concerns, I think, on both sides, from the media's perspective and from law enforcement. But it's clear he's not going to be able to do this alone. Ultimately, what we're seeing in other states is that legislation is being adopted to address this new technology. And so, while Attorney General Schimmel has taken the lead on this, ultimately we're going to need the legislature and the governor to work directly with law enforcement and the Attorney General's office to develop, some changes or some best practices in our current legislation.
We're talking about police body cameras and some of the open records and other issues they could raise with Attorney Sam Hall. Sam, one point you raise in your piece in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel is a practical question. Okay, we've got all this data, all this footage when we have these cameras in place. How do we keep it and how long do we keep it?
Well, that's a great question that, again, we need some direction from the state on. Wisconsin is one of the few states where we have a 6-year statute of limitations for civil rights cases. So when I represent a law enforcement officer when they're sued for excessive force or for a search claim, the plaintiff has 6 years to bring that claim. And so from my standpoint, I think this video footage ought to be preserved for 6 years. Part of the reason we're implementing these programs is undeniably to protect the officer. And we can't much protect the officer if we're destroying the video footage after 90 days or even after a year. Think back to the Albuquerque example that I mentioned with the young lady who was pulled over for the DUI and alleged that there was a sexual assault. Most of the time, those allegations aren't raised the day of the incident. They're raised months later, sometimes years later. And so I think I think our law enforcement officers deserve, I think we owe it to them to keep this video footage for the full 6 years in order to protect them from fraudulent claims.
And that could go the other way, I imagine, if somebody does have a legitimate civil rights violation claim and that audio is preserved to the time of the statute of limitations, that will prove their case as well.
Absolutely.
Another issue you look at is when is the camera on, when is the camera off? What kind of issues would factor into that when the state tries to grapple with that issue?
Well, I think a lot of this is going to relate to what kind of legislation, if any, do we see with regard to public disclosure of the video. So, I think if the legislation disfavors public disclosure, I think it's going to allow much more freedom to keep the cameras rolling more often because there's a risk of less harm. But, the issues generally are, criminal victims. If somebody is the victim of, let's say, a sexual assault, how willing are they going to be interviewed by law enforcement right after the incident while the camera's rolling? We face difficulty in this state and in the country with having crime victims come forward and report their crimes, particularly those types of violent assaults. And this could add just another layer of difficulty onto it. We also have a lot of police work that is best done, without cameras rolling. There's confidential informants who work, regularly with police to bring down, drug crimes. Obviously, those people are going to want to be videotaped. There's issues with, potentially illegal immigrants who may want to help, may want to report crime, and may be unwilling to do that if there's going to be video documentation of them. And then there's the privacy issues. When police enter a home, in order to conduct interviews or to investigate or even go into hospital rooms, there's video footage that's out in the public domain on YouTube showing, you know, officers going into a hospital room and interviewing somebody. You know, if I'm that person, I wouldn't want, you know, the entire cyberspace to see me in a hospital gown. And so those are also issues that have to be addressed.
Though there could be a case where someone's in their home or in that hospital bed and later claims maybe, I don't know, coercion for testimony from a police officer. So there's a benefit to having the camera on in that situation.
Sure, and I think that's why it's important that we have legislation that protects the officers in that standpoint. So look at what North Dakota did. They said if it's in a private place, it's not subject to public disclosure. Well, that means the officer can keep the camera running. You know, it's not going to be disclosed to the public, but the officer can keep the camera running in that situation, knowing that there's no risk of violating the person's privacy rights because it's never going to, you know, leave the police department.
Very briefly, Sam, as we wrap up, are you optimistic that laws like this can be in place before the cameras themselves are all over the place?
I think so. And I think what we're seeing in Wisconsin is that there's a lot of police chiefs and sheriffs that are prudently standing by. Nationally, about a third of police departments have instituted police body camera programs. In Wisconsin, from my experience, we're well below that average. And I think once, and I don't think that's going to change until there's some best practices established. So if you're out there and you're a proponent of getting more of these police body cameras on the street, the thing to do is to support the creation of these best practices that are going to govern how the cameras are used. And I think from then, you'll see more and more police chiefs and sheriffs begin to institute the programs.
Thanks to Sam Hall, attorney with Crivello Carlson, joining us to talk about police body cameras and laws relating to them here in Wisconsin. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up later, we'll hear about the Wisconsin sunflowers that are taking social media by storm.
First, after mining company Gogebic Taconite backed out on an iron ore mining project in the Pinoki Hills earlier this year, there's been a lot of talk over the future of mining in northern Wisconsin. Now, the owner of the property that would have housed that mine is speaking out.
Earlier this week, David Adams, president of LaPointe Iron Company, said mining in the Pinokies is inevitable, though a new project could be several years out. He also said that any new project would likely have to be carried out in a different way than GTAC's approach in the past few years.
Here with an update on what's happening on the iron mining front and to discuss the reaction to these comments is Danielle Kading, WPR's reporter in Superior. Danielle, good to have you back with us.
Hey, Rob. How you doing?
Well, these comments from David Adams got a lot of attention around the state and the region in particular. What did he have to say in particular about mining in northern Wisconsin?
Well, I haven't been able to speak to David Adams directly, but according to what the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel has reported, he's been said to have said that it is inevitable and that basically any new developer is going to have to take a much better approach as far as talking to local communities and working to build relationships there.
Now, what do we know about the potential amount of iron that, if a plan was in place, could be extracted in the Pinoki Hills?
The potential amount of iron? Well, there's a deposit that stretches around 22 miles between Ashland and Iron counties. What actually is economical to mine remains kind of a question because the deposit is sloped at kind of a 60% grade, so that has made it difficult to extract in the past. But GTAC was looking at a four-mile stretch between Ashland and Iron counties, and later on in the project, they had looked to do three or four smaller pits to avoid some of the wetlands there.
Now, you talked to a lot of stakeholders in the region and shared some of what they had to say with us. I want to start with Kelly Klein, Iron County Development Zone Coordinator. Here he is talking to you about the opportunity that exists in that region.
Like I said, I think it makes sense for Iron County to explore developing one of its resources. And I think we can do it in a way that's safe and doesn't ruin the environment, and yet can create some job and income opportunities for our residents.
Now, this last attempt at mining there was controversial, but do you think, from what you've heard, Danny, that Kelly Klein there represents a common school of thought there, that if we can do it right, there is room for an iron mine here?
Well, I think that's the general sentiment in Iron County, with some exception. I mean, there's opponents for the project both in Iron County and Ashland County, but Iron County officials have typically been in more favor of it, citing the potential for jobs in the area and the need to diversify their economy with one of the most aging populations in the state and the second highest unemployment rate in the state. For the first time in quite some time, they are typically number one in unemployment. And so they're looking to find any opportunity for jobs that they can. And they see this mineral deposit as something that should be explored. And so what Iron County officials are typically saying is that they would like to see more information, more science gathered about that deposit. And particularly in this instance, now that GTAC has gone out, they would like to see whatever information that GTAC collected be shared with the public, particularly the core samples that they have taken from the bulk sampling sites.
And you mentioned that the owner of the land there said, hey, if another company wants to come in and do this, and that they probably will, they'd have to do things differently this time around. So what kind of things would have to happen differently than with GTAC to make this actually happen?
Well, from what I've heard, both from Ashland County and Iron County officials that met with LaPointe Iron Company and Global Minerals Engineering, is that they're basically asking county officials, what did GTAC do wrong? What rubbed you the wrong way? And for officials in Ashland County, like Ashland County Board Chairman Pete Russo, he feels that there was no assurance that local governments would be supported as far as infrastructure. And more importantly, on the public health side of things, they cited issues where they feel that they were lied to or there were broken promises regarding incidents where there was a discovery of asbestos-like fibers, grunerite, in the rock at one of the sites within the proposed mine site. So there's concern there about whether they can establish trust again with any new developer and how they would go about doing that. And I think Iron County has said that, you know, the important thing there, at least with one county board member, Iron County board member Vic Wiemet, he's saying, let's get people in a room talking as early as possible about our concerns, about the things about this project that would make people adverse to it, and see if there's any way to deal with some of these impacts, like the grunerite. Is there a way to mitigate those risks? Is there a way to mitigate the wetlands without negatively harming the environment?
We're talking to WPR reporter Danielle Kading in Superior about the prospects for future iron mining in the northern part of the state. Danny, you just mentioned Vic Wiemet. Let's give a listen to him, Iron County board member.
The important thing is, from my perspective, is that the taxpayers and citizens of Iron County are treated with respect, that their ideas are honored, and that they're brought into, all of the stakeholders are brought into the process early on.
And that expands on what you were just saying there. Was there a sense among many in the region that last time around with GTAC that wasn't the case, that they weren't at the table?
Well, the last time around, and it's unclear as to whether history will repeat itself, there was criticism of GTAC for not reaching out to the Bad River Band early on as far as their plans or including them as much in that process. And Ashland County Board Chair Pete Russo asked LaPointe Iron County LaPointe Iron Company officials in the meeting with Ashland County on Thursday, have you talked to the tribe? Have you reached out to them? And he said that they were told that they did try to connect with the tribe, but they weren't able to make contact. And so I think there is an awareness now of the cultural significance of that watershed in that area where it would be mined. And also just talking to everyone involved, whether it's the state, local, or tribal officials.
And let's talk a little more about opposition to mining efforts in the region. Here's Charlie Ortman, Ashland County Board Supervisor and a Mining Impact Committee member.
They come in first and declare the inevitability of it being mined. so that you feel like you have to accept the best that you can get. Well, that's just a bunch of crap.
So, Danny, can you talk a little more about the heated opposition that's still out there?
Well, you know, people were frustrated with the way that Gogebic Taconite approached some of these concerns that they had. You know, right away when there was a public meeting at the very beginning of the process in which they were exploring mining that deposit, they had said that they were not going to go in and change any laws. And then later on in that process, we found Gogebic Taconite actually writing the law that was eventually passed and weakened environmental standards as it pertained to wetlands, and also changed the way in which local governments were compensated and how much say they had in the process. And I think that's a big concern for this area when with any new development that might be proposed for that site.
Danny, I got to say, watching this story in northern Wisconsin from down here in the southern half of the state, it seemed like when GTAC left, that was it, period. The iron mining story was done. Clearly, it is not. Has this been simmering? Is this still something people have been talking about up in those counties?
I think it's still on their minds, but honestly, quite a number of people that have been against the proposal to mine in the Pinocchio Hills are also turning their attention now to a 26,000 hog farm that's been proposed in Bayfield County. So there are a lot of land use issues that are kind of on either sides of northwestern Wisconsin, and there's just not a lot of people up there, and many of them are involved in the same discussions, and so I think they're trying to keep track of all the important issues pertaining to water quality and land use that they can when they're able.
And as we wrap up, I mean, this is a tentative discussion at this point. Is there any kind of talk about if this happens, how soon it could happen, this idea of opening up the idea of an iron mine?
Like I said, Rob, I haven't been able to talk to LaPointe Iron Company officials directly. They haven't returned my request for comment. But according to county officials, they're saying that this would not be something that would happen soon. That given the glut of iron ore on the market right now and prices being down, that this would be something that would be 5-10 years out. And so basically they feel that these conversations are feeling them out and seeing what would be done in the future to possibly move a development forward there in the Pinocchio Hills.
Danielle, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks.
That's Danielle Kading, WPR reporter in Superior, joining us to talk about future iron mining possibilities in northern Wisconsin.
Last year, pictures of the Lake Superior ice caves dominated social media. Well, this week, it's the sunflower field at Pope Farm Conservancy in Middleton. In just a few moments, we'll be taking your calls at 800-642-1234. And we want to know, what is the hidden treasure in your part of the state? You know, the cool place that locals know about, but maybe the word hasn't gotten out to the rest of the state yet. If you're willing to share your secret, give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post over on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll take your calls in a few minutes. First, a rare dragonfly found in Door County may help restore the species in other parts of the Midwest. Researchers are gathering the larvae of the Heinz Emerald Dragonfly and will eventually release them in the Chicago area. Patty Murray reports.
County Highway Q is in Bailey's Harbor. It cuts through Heinz Emerald Dragonfly habitat, which includes marshes and streams.
Lots of them cross this road, and lots of them get killed on this road. You know, almost 2,000 are killed on this road every year.
Dan Solick is a biology professor at the University of South Dakota. For nearly 20 years, he spent summers in Door County collecting the dragonfly and its larvae.
Hines was an investigator, a dragonfly expert.
There's a killer right there, right?
That is a totally killer, yeah. Big box traveling down the road pretty much and exceeding the speed limit to boot.
The Heinz Emerald is the only dragonfly on the endangered species list.
We thought it was extinct for several decades. No one could find the species.
Mike Grin is an ecologist with the Nature Conservancy. The group has about 5,000 acres of preserves in Door County and helps finance the Heinz researchers. He says the flies need healthy groundwater and find it on the peninsula.
They seem to utilize waters that have passed through either dolomite or limestone before it issues out in the springs.
The Heinz has it hard enough without having to worry about getting itself splattered on a windshield. It has big green eyes and either yellow or cream stripes on its body. It's an aquatic insect and spends the first 4 or 5 years of its life in wetlands or streams where females lay eggs. If one doesn't get eaten by a crayfish and actually makes it to adulthood, it only lives 4 to 7 weeks. That's why Salik hopes USD's captive rearing program will help the Heinz numbers.
Dragonflies lay 1,000 eggs. Maybe 10 of those actually ever live to become an adult. So what you do is you take those eggs and you put them in a controlled environment where mortality will be minimal, and suddenly you can generate hundreds of individuals that would have never survived otherwise.
The Heinz also lives in southwestern Wisconsin, the UP, Missouri, and near Chicago. This year, Salik's team will release larvae in wetlands there. He says that population is more genetically diverse than the one in Door County, but that the numbers are very low.
The Chicago population is really close to being at that critical threshold where it's just not going to be able to survive. And as it gets smaller, we're losing genetic diversity.
Salik says the Heinz emerald is an indicator species for groundwater.
In the Chicago area, one of its biggest threats is its threat to its habitat, but not even direct threat, because many of those places are protected as nature preserves. But a nature preserve is not protected if the sources of water that come into it aren't protected.
While he's talking, one of Salik's research assistants, Patricia Dombrowski, spots a Heinz emerald dragonfly and darts across queue.
Yeah, exactly. Did you just find another one?
Yeah, she just found another one.
What happened to it?
Patricia? It got hit by a car on zooming by.
Just now?
It was pretty fresh, yeah.
If all that doesn't convince people that preserving the Heinz is important, Salik says their favorite foods are mayflies and mosquitoes. Patty Murray, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Social media has been ablaze this week with pictures of a sprawling sunflower field here in Wisconsin. Pope Farm Conservancy has become the state's hottest attraction in the last week or so, with tons of people descending on the small Middleton Park to see the thousands of sunflowers in bloom there.
Kind of a similar story to what happened last year when photos of the Lake Superior ice caves took the world by storm and brought people from all over the state and beyond to northern Wisconsin.
And in both of those cases, these aren't new things by any means. Locals have known about the icy caves of Lake Superior, the sprawling fields of sunflowers at Pope Farm. But now there's social media, so these hidden treasures have become must-visit destinations for tourists and out-of-towners.
And so that got us thinking, what is your town's hidden treasure? Is there a natural place near you that's just begging to be discovered by the rest of the state? Do you think it could be the next ice caves or sunflower field? And if so, do you actually want the secret to get out? Well, we'd love to hear it. You can give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll get your calls in just a few moments. First, one of the bearers of the secret of the sunflower is with us now, our producer, Chris Molina. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Rob. Good to be here.
So you knew about this. You were into the sunflowers at Pope Farm way before it was cool.
It's true. I actually grew up about 5 minutes from the Pope Farm Conservancy, so I've been seeing the sunflowers for years and years and years, and there were a couple of years where I didn't go, and I went again last year, and I remember thinking, huh, there are a lot more people here now. But then this year, things just blew up.
There are traffic cops and stuff now, right?
Yeah. So I remember going to this, you know, little quaint park where, you know, maybe you'd bump into a couple of other people on the trail. And now there are traffic cops, there are porta potties, there are overflow parking lots, you know, in the side fields. It's crazy to me just to see this little park near my home explode into something, you know, much bigger.
Well, once you got porta potties, you know, you hit the big time.
You've hit the big time. That's
all right.
True.
Well, let's take a caller now. We've got Carol on the line at 800-642-1234. Carol joins us from Rice Lake. Hi, Carol.
Hi.
Hi, what is your hidden secret?
Our hidden secret is the Barron County Historical Society's Pioneer Village Museum, which is located between Cameron and Barron in Barron County. And it is just a wonderful historical museum with an entire village of historical buildings and many exhibit buildings that exhibit the history of Barron County as well as the history of the whole state. And just recently we've been adding some demonstration gardens by the Barron County Master Gardener volunteers, which include a rain garden of native prairie plants from the area, and we always have a vegetable garden that is reminiscent of something in history. So, for example, this year we have a World War II victory garden in our museum.
Oh, fantastic. Well, that's one I had not been to, the Pioneer Museum in Barron County. Yeah, lots of little museums sprinkled around the state that if you really get out there and look, there's some fantastic finds.
Definitely, and we're taking your calls, your hidden treasures of Wisconsin, the ones you know about, maybe want to share with the world, or maybe you'd rather keep to yourself. I don't know. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page, prompted by the sunflowers there in at Pope Farm in Middleton.
You know, another place that kind of comes to mind, at least for me, is the Spring Green Preserve, which we talked about a couple of weeks ago here on the show.
Did you go?
I haven't been.
I was thinking that too.
It's been on my list ever since we talked about it on the show. It's this little slice of desert almost in southern Wisconsin, and you know, desert-like plants, desert-like animals. You know, not necessarily a place you'd expect to see in Wisconsin. And I know that the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel also did a piece on this at some point. So I think, you know, traffic to this place has increased significantly. So yeah, definitely a hidden gem, but you know, once word gets out, it sort of changes things.
For me, I was thinking about this, and Blue Mountain State Park, a lot of people know about Blue Mountains, but have you guys, for instance, been up on the towers there?
I have been up a long, long time
ago. The towers are spectacular. I went for the first time in years when it was sunset, and it was beautiful. It was just spectacular. I was surprised there were not more people there enjoying the sunset.
Yeah, I know. It's a great state park. I think it sort of gets overshadowed by Devil's Lake, but Governor Dodge State Park. But yeah, both observation towers, and I go back and forth because there was always the one that I thought, this is the view, this is the great tower. The other one can't stack up, and then I go back another time, and I go on that tower. I'm like, no, this one is way better, so I feel conflicted.
There are two towers.
A note from Galen Druk. He tried to find the desert in that Spring Green Preserve, asked the general store. They said everybody had been asking about it, but they didn't know what it was, so they ended up not finding it, driving around. His friends thought he was crazy for trying to find a desert. I think, they knew. They knew. They're trying to keep the secret, people. I see you go back. Don't take no for an answer.
No porta potties, no overflow parking. That's the problem right there.
One of our comments from Facebook, when we asked, you know, what's your favorite hidden treasure in Wisconsin, somebody said, I have one, but I'm not going to share it with you because I don't want it to get all crowded and touristy. Well, I have one that can accommodate the tourists that, you know, is my show it to people from out of town, Olbrich Gardens. In Madison, botanical gardens outside, conservatory inside. That's a big hit for me. Really, really very striking. You can get into a hot, humid weather in the middle of January, which
not
is a nice change of pace.
Not a hidden treasure, per se.
Not all that
but
hidden, to be
definitely
fair.
A treasure, yeah.
You know, one other that comes to mind that I went to a little bit earlier this year, there's a state natural area called, I think it's Pewitt's Nest, if I'm remembering it correctly, and it's this little park near Baraboo that, you know, it sort of gets overshadowed by Devil's Lake, but, you know, it's got like a waterfall, it's got like some trails that you can go and hike on. I want to say I saw an article about this somewhere.
Not Parfrees Glen.
It's kind of in that same general geographic area, but also a really, really, really cool place. And I think word is kind of out on that one, because when I was there, there were a ton of people swimming and hanging out and doing a little bit of cliff jumping, which I'm not sure you're supposed to do, but a really cool state natural area.
And also in that area, I finally went to the Crane Foundation for the first time. Again, not exactly hidden, but I'd managed to not go there for 20 plus years of living in Wisconsin. So that was a big hit with me and the kids.
Right. So lots of stuff in the area, hidden or not. So I guess you have to beat the bushes a little to get the locals to tell you sometimes where some of this stuff is. But it's worth it.
Well, and who knows what the next thing will be, too. I mean, we'll open up Facebook in 3 months from now, and who knows what it's going to be. And I'm sure we'll be talking about this again.
Well, thank you so much, Chris, for coming on, talking sunflowers,
yeah.
And good to hear about the Pioneer Museum as well. If you've got one, why don't you post your favorite hidden treasure of your area over on the Central Time Facebook page?